the Happy Afloat podcast, tales of family adventures at sea.
Welcome aboard. Back for more? Now sit down and make yourself at home. I'm Jason, skipper of Happy Afloat. Meet my crew. Leon.
Hello.
Conrad.
Ahoy there, shipmates.
And my lovely wife, Sarah.
Hello. Do you want to sail around the UK with your family? You do? Excellent. You are in the right place.
For the less adventurous, the flower pressing class is next door.
Sailing a boat in UK waters is a great way of spending time with the family.
And we want a lot more families to take the plunge.
We've been passing on our knowledge and experience to kickstart your adventures.
So your family can start collecting the memories that will last a lifetime.
The sailing season is here.
And we have arrived at a lovely anchorage.
But how do we make sure we stay put with our anchor?
It's time to brush up on our anchoring techniques.
Which anchor?
We have only owned two types of anchor.
So do not expect an in-depth review on the anchors on the market.
All our boats came with a CQR anchor.
Sometimes a genuine CQR that has been made in Scotland.
Sometimes a no-brand copy.
So, with our first three boats, we just stuck with the CQR the boat came with.
And they all worked fine.
Also, with a CQR, you are in good company. The vast majority of boats have a CQR up front.
We must have anchored out many hundreds of times and have only dragged once that I can remember.
That was with a genuine CQR at Port Ellen on a windy night.
After a big party ashore.
We were on the 2004 Classic Maltz cruise in Scotland.
And a little the worse for wear.
Re-anchoring in the middle of the night in a gale with a fuzzy head is not to be recommended.
However, with our local cruising grounds of the East Coast rivers, anchoring is pretty easy.
The Medway's nickname of the Mudway is well earned.
The mud is so sticky and thick that I'm confident you could tie a teaspoon to the end of your road,
throw it overboard, and still be anchored securely.
Let's talk about our current setup on Happy Afloat.
When we bought Happy Afloat, a copycat CQR was in a very sad state.
The attachment point on the anchor for the shackle was worn quite thin.
And there was a lot of flaking rust.
So it seemed prudent to replace the anchor.
When replacing your anchor, there's two main considerations.
The cost.
And will it fit your bow roller and anchor locker setup?
As we had never had a problem with our CQRs, we were not motivated to spend a small fortune on a new generation anchor.
Meaning the Spades and Rockners of the world.
Also, it wasn't clear if they would fit our bow roller without modification.
But we did want to try out a new style of anchor.
So after reading many reviews, we came across the Plastimo Cobra.
Owners of the Cobra seem happy with its performance.
It would fit our bow roller without modification.
And it was pretty inexpensive.
Do you remember the days when you could order stuff from Europe and it would arrive a few days later and be cheaper than buying the same item from the UK?
Yes, I do. And I miss those days.
To be honest, I generally do.
The good old days.
What did you used to order from Europe?
Half of my video games come from Europe.
Well, they're not anchors, are they?
We're talking about boat stuff. Boat stuff is much more tricky to get hold of these days.
To be fair, getting anything from Europe these days is a lot harder than it used to be.
Correct. Anyway, we bought a 20kg Cobra 2 from Germany, as at the time that size wasn't available in the UK.
20 kilos is one size larger than the recommended size for our boat.
We used the Cobra on our last circumnavigation of the UK.
And we have used the anchor around 130 times since purchase.
In our opinion, it's much better than our old CQRs.
Sets quicker.
Never drags.
But everyone who buys a new anchor says the same.
So take our review with a pinch of salt.
We have 50 metres of chain that is attached to 50 metres of anchor road for those occasions when we are anchoring in very deep water.
We have a sturdy green pin shackle for securing our chain to the anchor and prefer not to use a swivel system.
What is the green pin shackle?
When I was doing some research on what shackles to use for attaching the anchor to the chain, I came across these green pin ones, which are used a lot more in the commercial lifting market. And I did actually notice that they sell them on Jimmy Green as well, but they're not the sort of thing you tend to find in the mainstream chandlers. So I went online and ordered some.
Our anchor chain is marked at 5 metre intervals with coloured cable ties.
The coding system for the colours and depths is written on the inside of our anchor locker, so anyone can use it. Anchoring.
Basically, you want a spot protected from the wind and the swirl.
Charts, pilots and almanacs will show popular spots.
Once you have found a place that is not too crowded,
you will need some tidal info before dropping your anchor.
The tidal range, which is the difference between high and low water at your current location,
and at what point in the range we are attempting to anchor.
The goal is to still be floating at low water.
We use the rule of twelfths to determine how much water has to rise.
And more importantly, fall.
Come on, Sarah, explain the rule of twelfths to us.
Okay, an example here for the rule of twelfths is if your tidal range, difference between high and low water, is 2.4 metres, nice easy number there to work with, you divide it by 12, which is going to be 20 centimetres. So each twelfth is 20 centimetres. So the rise of tide goes 1 twelfth, 2 twelfths, 3 twelfths, 3 twelfths, 2 twelfths, 1 twelfth.
That's every hour, yes?
Yeah, for every hour. So if you were arriving 3 hours after low water, you would go 1 twelfth, 2 twelfths, 3 twelfths, which is 6 twelfths. And so 6 lots of 20 centimetres is 1.2 metres. If you were arriving 4 hours after low water, it'd be 1 twelfth, 2 twelfths, 3 twelfths, 3 twelfths. So then it's 9 twelfths, or 9 times 2, 9 times 20, is 1.8 metres.
So let's say we've arrived at the anchorage 2 hours after high water. You've got your tidal range of 2.4. We want to know how much the tide is going to drop by so we know how deep to anchor. What do we need to... what's the calculation?
I would do it in reverse and I would go, you've 2 hours after, so it's 1 twelfth add 2 twelfths, which is 3 twelfths. It's a quarter, or 3 times 20 is 60 centimetres. So it has already dropped by 60 centimetres. 2.4 metres minus 60 centimetres is 1.8 metres. So you've still got 1.8 metres for the tide to drop.
You'd give that information to me and I'd make sure we have at least
2 metres
under the keel.
Yeah. To be conservative.
If we know that the water will drop by 3 metres, we want to make sure there's at least 3 metres under the keel, preferably more, because unless you're in the mudway, you probably don't want your keel to get anywhere near the bottom.
If you are planning to stay a few days, check to see if the low waters are getting lower to avoid any surprises.
When anchoring, we go with the belief that the chain is more use out of the locker than in the locker.
The scope of chain we let out is usually 4 times the depth at high water.
When setting the anchor, we let wind and tide do the hard work for us, rather than ramming the engine into reverse at the start.
We nearly always use the electric windlass to let the chain out, just because it's easier.
Once the chain has been let out, I keep 1 foot on the chain near the windlass to feel for any vibrations or bumping, which would indicate an anchor dragging.
We then give some gentle revs in reverse with the engine to make sure.
Obviously, the amount of revs required for checking will depend on the expected wind conditions.
There's not a lot to be gained by whacking the engine in reverse at 3,000 RPM if you're expecting a Force 2 overnight. To be honest, we rarely use more than 1,000 RPM regardless of what we're expecting.
When we're happy that the anchor has dug in, we tie on a snubber line with a rolling hitch knot.
The snubber line proves really helpful in eliminating the tension on the windlass and gives a little bit of stretch for those annoying moments when the wash of another vessel hits the boat.
When the anchor is set and the anchor ball has been hoisted, it's time to settle down in the cockpit and enjoy the scenery, which is the point of sailing, isn't it?
Do we have any top tips about those that are nervous about anchoring overnight, Sarah?
I have to say I generally have my best night's sleep when we're at anchor, unless it's a particularly windy night.
Because I know in the early days, we were, our first couple of anchoring
out. We were quite terrified, weren't we?
Worried that you're going to end up on the lee shore and up on out of the water, heeled over, crashing into the rocks or the mud.
Do you remember when we did the classic Maltz cruise in another boat we met and they literally did, like us, they were scared and they put pots and pans out on the on a line? Do you not remember that?
And what's the advantage of putting pots and pans out on the line?
That they would go clonk. If you were dragging, they would clonk, that you'd hear the pans bashing together.
So what did they tie the pans to?
A line onto, like a snubber line type thing.
Oh, right.
Do you not remember that?
Yeah, but you've actually brought up the point. If you are dragging and you're in the forepeak, you will hear...
You will hear it.
You'll hear the chain rumbling, and that's an indication that you're dragging.
Yeah.
We do occasionally, if we are not overly confident with the anchorage, keep the depth sounder on with a shallow anchor warning.
Yeah, we do. We've only done that on this boat, though, haven't we? I don't think we've ever done it on other boats, probably because we didn't have such a feature.
No, I think you'd just be nervous the first time, first couple of times you do it, but then you soon get used to it, and it then doesn't become too much of an issue, and you usually get a much better light sleep than in a
funky marina. You don't have to listen to other people's halyards banging on masts.
And there's various apps if you want to set sort of anchor dragging alarms and stuff like that.
And also, I think it's if you're nervous, drop the anchor during the daytime rather than in the evening. So you've got the benefit of both states of tide in daylight before you go to sleep. And if you haven't budged, say you've dropped the hooker halfway through a tide, a bit high or low water, and you go all the way to high or low water, back out the other side a bit. And if you haven't budged, you're not likely to budge at that point, and then you can rest easy.
Yeah, and another technique to make sure you aren't actually moving is to line up a stanchion or two objects on shore so you can sort of know. Line them up, and if you're moving, they'll start moving away from each other. Last time we anchored, when it was gusting, that was an 047, there was a buoy nearby us, and I was lining up with a drying rock. And as long as the two were in line from the cockpit, I knew that the boat wasn't dragging backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed in that same. So a quick check to make sure you're not dragging, because sometimes your mind can play tricks on you, especially if you're just popping your head up to have a look around. As long as those transits are still in line, you know you haven't moved anywhere, regardless of what your mind thinks.
Yeah, actually, because right now we're anchored by a little beach, aren't we? And we haven't budged because the beach is still pretty much in the same location as it was when we dropped the hook. In lifting the anchor, it's pretty much a case of untying the snubber line and using the electric windlass to do the hard work of pulling the chain back on board.
While directing the helm to position the boat over the anchor, forwards, back, left, right, etc.
Our anchor locker has an unfortunate design flaw in that the chain doesn't neatly fall to the bottom and has a tendency to pile up and then eventually jam the windlass.
This has been rectified by much research on internet yachting forums and resolved with placing a traffic cone cut in half in the anchor locker to aid the falling of the incoming chain, and although it's not perfect, it works pretty well.
We do have a second anchor in the cockpit locker.
I think it's a Danforth style job.
We have never had to use a second or spare anchor, but it does make sense to carry one, especially a style that folds flattish.
Our top upgrade tip for your windlass is to install a wireless remote.
Happy Afloat came with a wired remote.
And predictably, it didn't work.
Wired remotes never seem to.
Either the wires on the remote have rotted out,
or the socket in the anchor locker is corroded.
A wireless remote solves these issues. They are very cheap.
eBay or Amazon will sell a wireless remote for the 4x4 vehicle winch market.
These work perfectly with a windlass.
Very easy to install and only cost around £10 to £20.
We've installed these remotes on our last two boats and always keep an extra one just as a spare.
Just in case there was an unfortunate moment where the remote falls into the drink.
Yeah, another top tip with those remotes is they don't take standard size batteries. So open them up and buy yourself some spare batteries, because there aren't they 4As?
Oh, are they? They're tiny ones.
Yeah, tiny ones. And we have got some spares on board. But yeah, just bear that in mind. But most of them come with two remotes. And I think we've never actually gone for a battery in 2 years, have we?
No. Now you said that, we will.
But triple A's, they're like the rarest kind of battery I've ever seen.
Yes, that's why we bought spares, because it's not something you're going to come across when you're in the middle of nowhere.
Okay, we know how to get to that awesome anchorage
and stay anchored to the spot.
I think the time has come to go on a summer adventure.
That's a story for another day.
Thank you for sticking us in your ears.
Have we got any feedback?
We've had a lovely email from one of our listeners whose family is going on a summer adventure between Chichester and Cornwall and are looking for some destination recommendations.
What do we think then, guys?
Plymouth?
Where in Plymouth would you recommend?
I think we've only been to one place in Plymouth.
Which place are you thinking of?
The one with the good skimming stones.
That was Jenny Cliff Bay, wasn't it?
Yep, stone skimming, that's a good beach for finding skimming stones. And also, didn't we find some sea anemones there?
I think we did. They had massive boulders, didn't they? Rocks, like a rock pooling area.
Yeah.
Obviously not laid on as a rock pooling area, but...
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to get ashore with your dinghy.
It was. And there was a cafe at the top of the cliff.
Yeah, there's a winding path to get up to, and at the top there is a cafe and a grassy area, isn't it?
Mm. Along. It was quite nice, actually.
Any other recommendations if you're going from the Solent to Cornwall?
Get a Cornish pasty.
Where are you going to get Cornish pasty from?
Cornwall.
That would be Falmouth, and I guess would be the easiest spot to get Cornish pasties.
Yeah.
We've spoken about Falmouth before, so look up that episode.
I think that Hope Cove.
Which Hope Cove?
We've been to a few, haven't we? The one near Bolttail.
But just past Salcombe, isn't it?
Yeah. That was lovely.
That is. That's a tiny little, I think it must have been an old fishing village. Got a lovely sandy beach.
And really nice rocky area, hasn't it?
Yep. And then literally right on your doorstep is cafes, ice cream shops. I think there's probably a pub there as well, isn't there?
Yeah. It's very small. There isn't much there, but what there is nice.
Though you need to go there in pretty settled weather. And I think you can only go there if it's an easterly as well.
Yeah, it's quite exposed to the west, isn't it?
But it's a lovely spot.
Lovely.
Any other recommendations? What about Weymouth, guys? What do you think about Weymouth?
I remember Weymouth.
What's not to like about Weymouth?
Weymouth?
You don't remember Weymouth?
No.
Really? All the spaces that you insisted on playing at?
And the fish and chips.
And the big sandy beaches and the donkey rides and the ice creams.
What donkey rides?
There was donkey rides on the beach.
You guys didn't do donkey rides, but there were donkey rides on the beach.
You tell me you don't remember Weymouth?
No.
You went on that awful fairground ride that made you feel really ill, and then about 10 minutes later you decided you were going on it again.
And did you feel ill because of the combination of fish and chips and the ride, or just the ride?
Do you not remember? Nobody else would go on it with you because it looks so horrible.
It's best not to eat and go on the roller coaster as well.
Yeah, Weymouth is the one where we go to Portland Marina. It's nice and easy to get into and plenty of space. And then we usually take a bus into town that goes along the causeway.
Okay.
Still don't remember it?
I can't believe you can't. And it's got those sand sculptures, hasn't it? It has that stand by the promenade. Some people, person has carved out loads of sort of figurines and things.
It's a permanent display, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a permanent area for sand sculptures.
Quite impressive.
I can't believe you can't remember Weymouth, because you literally told us the best fish and chips you had on the last summer adventure came from there.
Massive pause. Conrad, do you remember Weymouth?
Yep, because we always call it Weymouth.
So Weymouth, anywhere else? We haven't been to Salcombe for quite a few years, 15, 16 years? But we do have a picture of our very first boat at Sunny Cove, which looks like a very sandy beach, because we took the picture from the other side of the river.
Yeah, it does. There was very nice sand there.
Ordinance.
All soft, whitey, yet very light yellow sand.
And according to the West Country Cruising Companion by Mark Fishwick, it is very popular. So if you're going to go along the West Country, I would recommend getting that particular book. Have you got any other top tips?
We like the Helford River.
Let's talk about the Helford River. So the Helford River, where do we usually anchor?
As you're going into the Helford River on your port side, Ponsonance Cove, I think it's called.
A couple of little beaches and rocky bits there as well. You can easily get ashore with your dinghy and explore.
And you can access then a footpath, can't you? When I say footpath, I mean like a country-style footpath.
Yep, so that's another top spot, Helford River.
Yeah, it was nice, wasn't it? In fact, there were a few people on the beach there, weren't they?
There was. It seems to be a popular spot as well. And also, we caught fish at that particular cruise as well. We caught mackerel there. Yeah. Any other recommendations for spots to stop at? For your little ones?
Anywhere with a castle.
Well, Weymouth has a castle at the...
By Portland, doesn't it? Can't think of anywhere else in particular along the south coast. They're all the places that we've generally stopped.
Conrad, have you got any book recommendations for this episode?
Yes, I do. Today I'll be recommending Alessia in Atlantis, The Forbidden Vial by Nathalie Lane.
Okay, tell us more about it.
All right, so first off, I'm recommending this for Harry Potter fans due to the plot for this book, the first one in its series, if it does become a series, is a lot like The Philosopher's Stone, except if you replace...
No spoilers.
I was about to say, if you replace Hogwarts for Atlantis.
Oh, okay.
And so, it starts with Alessia at a boarding school, and on break, Alessia goes out to the seaside and a Grindlow attacks.
A Grindlow? Do we need to know what a Grindlow is?
Call it a frog monster.
Frog monster. I hope you're not giving out any more spoilers.
No, I don't want to give out too many spoilers. Otherwise, you might as well not read the book.
Okay, so what? You like it? You think other kids are going to enjoy it?
Yep, especially if they like the J.K. Rowling books.
Okay.
Mostly Harry Potter.
Yeah, I think everyone knows who J.K. Rowling is and who Harry Potter is. How did you find out about the book, Conrad?
Mum told me about it.
Sarah, how did you find out about the book?
Well, we found out about it by watching a sailing YouTuber, Patrick Lane, and he mentioned it because it's written by his daughter.
If you don't know Patrick Lane and you are a avid YouTube watcher of sailing channels, you should probably have a look at his stuff. He's a single-hander and he goes off all round, plays single-handing, usually out to the Azores. He's gone off to Iceland. It's definitely worth watching his channel for some interesting tips. The best top tip that we got from watching his channel was the docking stick.
It was. Highly recommend a docking stick for your parking practice. And a docking stick, we can recommend it again because it's very useful for docking and the kids can use it.
Have we spoken about the docking stick before?
I'm not sure, but it's still worth saying because We are quite happy to talk about it to anyone that goes, oh, what's that you've got?
Maybe we need to have a whole episode on the docking stick.
If you have any questions or a book recommendation, let us know.
We love feedback.
Send an email or a posting on Facebook. All relevant links are on the website, happyafloat.com.
And if you know someone who would enjoy the podcast, direct them to our website, happyafloat.com.
From our website, they can listen to the podcast. Sharing is caring.
And don't forget to follow us on your favourite podcast app.
News and updates.
Okay, as promised, Tales from the Hard.
Naturally, the weather was idyllic for being out on the water during the 4 weeks we were out on the Hard.
Whilst it was better than being rained on, it was definitely very hot.
But there was an ice cream van which stopped outside the boatyard at weekends.
Needless to say, much ice cream was regularly consumed as a reward for all our hard work with boat maintenance.
We were unfortunate to be located in the mosquito-infested corner of the boatyard.
In the location closest to the neighbouring woodland, the heat didn't deter the little biters.
And all day long, they were busy trying to attack us.
Fortunately, we were well prepared with our Avon Skin So Soft Spray, which works amazingly well as a mosquito repellent.
Or not. Who else was bitten after plying this snake oil?
Me?
Yeah, I was bitten loads of times.
I seem to fare fairly well.
Okay, so it works for you.
That's all that matters. Our most significant reason for being hauled out was to change the seacocks. We'd bought the new seacocks well over a year ago, pre-COVID.
In fact, so long ago that the sealant we bought at the same time had long expired.
Replacing them was a fairly straightforward and not too tricky task, apart from the battle with the holding tank hose, which proved extremely inflexible.
We are so glad to have finally got rid of our old originals and very happy to have replaced them with True Design composite ones.
No more worrying about whether the through hull is secretly de-zinking.
Just waiting to sink your boat.
Of course, once out of the water, there are many other jobs to do too.
We have scraped and primed the keel with rust eater and anti-foul primer, as well as pulling out the old sealant and refilling the keel joint with a fresh helping of CT1 sealant.
The entire boat has been primed and painted with 2 to 3 coats of anti-fouling,
being 4 2.5-litre tins until they were all used up.
If you have followed our podcast from the beginning, you will know that we suspected our propeller was the wrong size for our engine.
After much procrastination, we decided to go for a new prop.
We did some homework and opted for a feathering three-bladed prop from Darglow.
It was basically a choice between the Featherstream or the Flexofold, both sold by Darglow. The Featherstream is manufactured by them, whereas the Flexofold is made in Denmark and resold by Darglow. As the Featherstream was quite a bit cheaper than the Flexofold, it was a done deal, and it only took about a week from order for Darglow to make and ship the new prop to us.
Getting the old prop off was an easy job, and equally as easy to sell on good old eBay. However, installing the new prop was a different story.
We had the prop about 3 weeks before we need to go back in the water, and we didn't really want to leave our shiny prop in the corner of the boatyard by a fence that was quite easy to climb for someone to basically walk off with
and
1600 quid's worth of prop. So we dry fitted it. It all looked good, and it's sort of no feathered, no problem at all. And then we put it back in its box and took it home. And then we had a debate about whether we should install it a few hours before being launched. And then we decided to install it the day before and just put a bin bag over it and hope that no one would notice.
And please note the day was a Sunday.
So the day of launch was going to be on the Monday. And on the Sunday, we decided we'll actually fit the prop just to make sure it's working and then just put a bag over it to hide it. And hopefully no one will walk off of it in the meantime. First thing Sunday morning, we put prop on and the feathering didn't work. It was too stiff. Something was obviously wrong. So we took it all apart again, put it back together again. And still, the feathering wasn't really working.
But it was working fine when we took it off of the shelf.
Yes, it's every time we sort of talked up the locking nut, not close to the torquing recommendations in the instructions, just literally nipping it up a little bit, it would bind. The added complication is we have an ambassador rope stripper on, so that involves an adapter plate that you sort of put on with the Featherstream. So we thought maybe that was binding, but no, took it off, checked it, that was all good, and we'd also recently serviced the ambassador's rope cutter. By the fourth time that we'd taken it apart and reassembled, I thought the problem maybe with one of the locking washers just slightly touching the hub. So we sort of jiggled it around, and as I was tightening it, I was jiggling the hub, and so the fourth time it was all working fine, but we're a bit paranoid now. So we tightened up to the right Torx levels, which isn't very much at all, as it turns out. And every time we walked past the prop, we'd give it a turn and a twiddle and sort of make sure the feathering was still working. And we must have twiddled and turned the prop several hundred times that day. every time someone walked past, I'd insist that they'd give it a go.
We did also email Darglow. Well, we tried phoning them, but obviously it was a Sunday, so they weren't going to be in. And we did email them with our panic-stricken message of help, we're not sure this is correct. And they did come back to us and say all was good, didn't they?
Well, no, they said phone us.
Well, they did say phone us.
And we contacted them on the phone.
Yeah.
And sort of talked us through all the scenarios and said, no, it sounds like it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Now that it's feathering properly, and maybe it was just binding and...
And that we didn't need to torque it as high as the...
No, in fact, actually, the torque recommendations is the maximum. And they were saying it really doesn't need to be torqued at all because there's another locking nut that actually does all the work.
Yeah.
If you over-torque it, there is a severe danger you could actually destroy the hub.
That bit of information would be quite useful in the instructions.
Yes. So, yes, he sort of set our mind a bit at rest. Anyway, yeah. Right, so launch day, we're still fiddling with it, and we're still sort of, is it getting looser? Is it getting tighter? Is the feathering going to work? So we're quite paranoid about the actual launch and whether or not the prop was actually going to work, because the first thing we have to do is to reverse off.
Yeah, out of the sling.
Yes, so we're a bit concerned. And of course, the added complication was we didn't have the choice of putting the old prop back on.
Because we'd sold it.
The week before on eBay.
Yes. Oh, well. Of course, once on, the worry was would it work once in the water, or would we be destined for more time on the hard resolving propeller problems?
Also, the rubber bumper on the sugar scoop was in much need of TLC.
It was poorly sealed to the hull and had ridiculous screw holes in it where the original owner tried to fix it in place. In fact, once we had the boat out of the water, you could see it was barely attached at all at the bottom. There's quite a lot of horrible green gunge oozing out of it.
And it was generally quite battered and worn.
It was also an unsightly colour that resisted all attempts to clean it.
We made a last-minute decision and decided to take it off and maybe replace it.
Removing it from the hull was a bit of a struggle. Although only about a third of it was still attached to the scoop, it was bonded pretty well.
Once off, a dodgy repair to the transom was revealed. Now add some fibreglass work to the list of jobs to do too.
This was starting to turn into one of those jobs you wish you'd never started.
Placing it wasn't going to be an option in the timescale available.
As lead times for parts are now measured in weeks, not days, for anything from Europe. After some research, we tried and would now highly recommend a PVC solvent cleaner, which is a simple wipe-on, wipe-off affair which revives PVC materials.
The cleaner also works brilliantly on cleaning up fenders as well.
I think we used a brand called Everbuild.
Yeah, sold for reviving your double glazing window frames. The biggest job was removing the old ceiling from the sugar scoop, and it took about 2 days of scraping, cutting and trying to dissolve the stuff.
And we used a solvent remover for that, didn't we?
The CT1 solvent, which they sell in spray cans.
And then four tubes of CT1 sealant and the bumper was secured back on the scoop.
The screw holes and gouges were covered over with more CT1.
And although not perfect, it looks 1,000 times better than before.
Another top tip that was given to us in the boatyard was to use Harpic limescale remover, that's the blue one, to clean the sort of yellow scum marks on the hull.
It was a technique we hadn't heard of before, but we thought we'd give it a go. It costs about £1.50 a bottle compared to the extortionate cost of specific boat cleaning materials, such as oxalic acid products like Y10.
We can proudly report that it is a miracle product, and after we literally brush painted the hull with Harpic and then washed it up,
all the horrible scummy marks had gone.
Jason spent many days battling with the heat, polishing the hull.
Up and down a ladder several hundred times.
You used an electric polishing machine and 3M polish, which was the one in the purple bottle, and to bring the topsides up to a gleaming finish.
And revealing more repairs that will need addressing in the future. More work.
So, on splash day, we were extremely nervous about our propeller. And I didn't sleep the night before.
But it worked a treat.
Our boat has never gone so fast under power.
We are so happy with it and will no doubt report more on it in future episodes.
Being on the hard is super stressful and we're happy to be back on the water.
Or is it in the water?
Isn't that like the classic debate of scone or scone, on or in the water? Because it floats on the water, yet the bottom of the hull and the keel are in the water.
After a few more days of cleaning the decks and provisioning the stores, we were ready for an adventure.
Next time aboard Happy Afloat.
We're going to take you on a summer adventure.
Until next time, happy sailing!